You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, in-person classes, and customized corporate workshops and performances. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. You can go online and find out all the information you need at secondcity.com.
I loved this book by Annie Murphy-Paul. She's a magazine journalist and a book author who writes about the biological and social sciences. Her new book is called The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain. And this has really changed the way I think about thinking. And I highly recommend it to anyone. It's a great book. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Annie Murphy-Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
My wife read The Extended Mind and couldn't stop talking about it. And indeed, having read the book, I find myself with this all these whole new ways of considering my thinking and feeling state. And to this point, I sleepwalk on occasion. And the other night I was sleepwalking and I tripped and I banged into my dresser.
Oh,
and so now you have to look at my black eye on this Zoom. Thank God my listeners don't. But I'm actually wondering now what my body was telling me, as opposed to trying to figure out all this stuff in my mind. And that is a new way to consider. And of course, we'll be coming up at therapy in just a few hours.
Wow, that's interesting. I've never been asked a question like that, because although my book does talk about how we think with the body and not just with the brain, I've never thought about the body thinking during sleep, but it does speak to your experience, does speak to the fact that we evolved to move. We're born to move. And actually, usually when we're asleep, there's an inhibition that happens that keeps us from getting up out of our beds and walking around. And in people who sleepwalk, that fails for some reason. But as to the larger meaning of that, I mean, were you having any dreams while you were sleepwalking?
Probably. I don't remember my dreams. I don't know. What I found so interesting about it, and this is just generally speaking after reading the book, is, and you sort of say this for yourself as this research, you begin to see the evidence coming in, and then recognizing like what I love about the book is the bad metaphors. You start with these terrible metaphors that have us thinking about thinking incorrectly. So maybe that's a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So one of the most common and pervasive metaphors for the brain is that the brain is like a computer. Mm-hmm. And there's some ways in which this is accurate. I mean, the brain processes information, but it doesn't do it in the same way that a computer does. And so that really leads us down some unfortunate paths when we assume that, for example, the body has nothing to contribute to intelligent thought because everything's going on above the neck, you know, in this information processor that we have inside our heads. Or it leads us astray when we assume that where we are doesn't affect how we think, because that's true for a computer. You know, my laptop here works the same, whether it's here in my home office, or, you know, if I were to take it to a park and it was operating outside, it would work just the same way. But human brains are very different. They're context sensitive such that they're really affected by where they are and what kind of state they're in. And then finally, you know, computers don't have friends, as far as we know. They don't have colleagues or classmates, and so they're not affected by the minds of other people the way we are so profoundly affected by our social relationships. So to think of a brain like a computer is really to cut off many of the wellsprings of human intelligence and to really misunderstand and undervalue what our kind of intelligence, the human kind of intelligence, is all about.
And then the other metaphor, which is the brain as a muscle, which is something, I mean, I've used that muscle term probably incorrectly for other things when I'm talking about improvisation and other things. But of course I've loved in the past Carol Dweck's work around growth mindset, but this is a troubling metaphor, and tell us why.
Yeah. And, you know, there again, there's a kernel of truth to it and a kernel of value, because I too really like Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset. And it's a positive and encouraging message to say to students, for example, that when you exercise your brain, you're making it stronger and you can get smarter that way. But it is limited in the sense that, once you're exercising your brain at its max, you know, where do you go from there? And it assumes that all the things we do to get smarter have to happen inside our head, when really the best way, in my view, the most efficient and effective way to think more intelligently is to become a skilled user of things that are outside the brain, you know, the body and physical spaces and relationships with other people, bringing those into the thinking process rather than relying on the brain alone.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of info, there was a Second City scene that talked about this way back, where it was a husband and wife talking about the amount of information that they store in each other's brains, including which cousin is a jerk, you know, how much can I drink at night, that sort of thing. And the reason it always got the laugh it did was because people are recognizing the sort of essential truth about that, but that we don't talk about that way normally.
We don't talk about that
we're actually doing that. That's why I was a surprise to people in the audience, because we all do that to a certain extent in our relationships, I think.
We build this thing that psychologists call a transactive memory system, where we rely on other people to carry parts of our memories around with them. Yeah. And that's why, you know, the end of a relationship can feel so devastating, because you're not just losing all that emotional support, but you're also, in a sense, losing part of your mind and your memory. And it can be very disorienting for that reason.
You introduce us to a term, interoception, if I'm saying that correctly. Tell us what that is.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's a like technical wonky kind of term for what the rest of us know as gut feelings, you know, this this flow of internal sensation that's really with us all the time. You know, we can sense, many of us can sense our hearts beating, or we feel butterflies in our stomach. We might feel our heart racing if we're really worked up about something. And it turns out that those physical internal cues are carrying information. You know, that's our body responding to the situation that we're encountering and giving us messages about how to handle it. But if we're not in touch with those internal sensations, and there's a lot of pressures in our culture to kind of push those internal signals and cues aside and sort of power through, you know, and focus just on your thinking and on your mental operations. When we do that, we lose touch with, we lose access to this really rich repository of information and experience that is stored in the body.
So you have a story and a character that you talk to us to sort of illustrate that. And that's John Coates, who was a Merrill Lynch trader. And then he studied traders on the London floor. That was fascinating, I thought.
Yeah. This was a cool study. So he gave a group of London financial traders in London. He gave a group of them the heartbeat detection test, which is a kind of standard test for it uses our awareness of our heartbeat as a proxy for how in tune are you with your internal sensations. And it's who take the test are asked to guess when their own heart is beating, and people are more and less accurate in their judgments. And he also gave the heartbeat detection test to a group of control group, like a group of people off the street. And it turns out that the financial traders were much more attuned to their heartbeats. They were much more attuned to their interoceptive sensations. And moreover, that the more successful traders, the ones who had been making more money, were the most attuned to their heartbeat and to their internal sensations. And what's so interesting to me about this study is that we think of, at least I think of finance as being kind of like, you know, all about sort of big brain, you know, number crunching, mm-hmm. a very kind of cerebral kind of undertaking. But it turned out that the people who were best at this activity were those who were tuned into their bodies. And, you know, that goes against this whole cultural bias we have, wherein we believe that the body is kind of irrational and unruly and ungovernable, you know, and it's the brain and the mind that are really calling the shots. But in fact, it's those traders who were most in tune with their bodies who were able to make the smartest decisions.
Yeah, we spoke to Lauren Nordgren from Northwestern recently about his new book. And there's a story in there about the best car salesman in Michigan, who's this guy who's just in tune with human beings. If they sense that they can get a better deal somewhere else, he sends them there. And it's just so anti-sales in terms of, especially like anyone who's bought a car, right? It's like, it is the most upsetting experience. It's never good. You're always getting screwed. It's just terrible.
Yeah, so interesting. And in fact, interoception can play a role in our relationships with other people and not just with our own selves. You know, some of the most interesting research that I came across had to do with social interoception and the fact that, you know, we don't have direct access to what another person is thinking. Their brain is kind of a black box from our perspective. But the way we're able to sense what other people are feeling is by, you know, when we're engaged with someone face-to-face talking, we very subtly and automatically and unconsciously mimic their facial expressions mm-hmm. and their gestures and their posture. And then we read off our own bodies, what that makes us feel like, you know, and therapists actually are the champions of this. You know, they're trained to use their own bodies as a tool for understanding what their patients are feeling, and the patients themselves may not even really be aware of it.
For sure. The section on thinking with movement was particularly interesting to me. And I don't know if you know the origin story of like the improv games that became Second City, but they were created by a social worker in the 1920s and 30s at Jane Addams Hull House in the South Side of Chicago.
Oh, I didn't know that. How interesting.
So she created these games to better assimilate the immigrant children coming into her care. Many of them were in gibberish and were very movement-based because the kids didn't always share language. Mm-hmm. And then her son, Paul Sills, teaches it to Nichols and May and other people, and it becomes the Second City. But it's still, I think, the sort of transformative power of the exercises and why so many people take classes in improv, not to get on Saturday Night Live, but because they find it's a bit of therapeutic, is for some of the reasons you talk about here with regard to, it enhances your ability to think when you move. So I'd love you to talk a little bit about the things that you talk about in the book around that.
Yeah. And I'll just note that, you know, when an author writes a book, you don't know until it's published who's going to respond to it, who's going to find it of interest. And one of the most gratifying things about publishing The Extended Mind was finding that lots of people in the arts really got this book. And I think that's because artists of all stripes have always thought with their bodies and with physical space and with collaborations with other people. So it was kind of like, they were primed for this, you know, this.
Because you probably weren't writing it for the artist community. I don't think.
I wasn't. Although when I think about it, the book does include a number of stories about artists like Jackson Pollock So the movement piece is interesting because there's so many ways in which movement informs our thinking and can advance our thinking. You know, one that's particularly relevant to improv is gesture, of course. And And, you know, it's scientists have found that people speak and think less, less fluently, less effectively when they're prevented from gesturing. Gesturing is not just kind of a hand waving, you know, like add on to speech. It's actually an integral part of the thinking process. And what's interesting is that, people like teachers who want to help others understand and learn, it's actually a good idea for teachers and instructors of other kinds to get people gesturing, because that helps them with their thinking process. And one way to get people gesturing is to put them in a situation where they are improvising, where they are describing or explaining. They're on the spot. They're not prepared. You know, that they're being called upon to do it on the spot in front of other people. And because that's a really intellectually, mentally taxing kind of activity, automatically people gesture more because they're offloading some of that mental burden onto their hands. And then in turn, because they're gesturing so much, that gesture feeds back into their thinking processes and actually helps them to learn and to understand better.
Yeah, one of my lines I use about improv is that it's human being practice. So there's all these sort of exercises that allow you to just focus on the thing, whether it's listening or collaborating or you know, making it up. And the other thing that in the gesturing thing, of course, but then also the idea of, we know when, because we write our shows through improvisation, and it's only scripted by like the end. But often the actors they know their lines when things are blocked. So the minute you're setting up where you're going to be, that becomes much easier. And you talk about that as being a thing for people.
Yeah, so there's a very interesting research pair at Elmhurst University. It's made up of a team of husband and wife. And the wife is a psychologist, Helga Noyce, and her husband, Tony, is an actor. And together they study the psychology of memory in actors. And they find, you know, I guess this isn't surprising, but they find that actors have unbelievable memory for lines. You know, even many months after they've performed in a play, they can recall their dialogue with upwards of 90% accuracy. And what the Noyces have found that is so interesting is that, first of all, in their interviews with actors, they hear over and over again actors saying, well, I never try to learn my lines until the play has been blocked, until I know how and where I'm going to be moving with my body, because the lines actually kind of get attached to those movements. And it wouldn't make any sense for me to learn the lines without knowing what the corresponding actions are. And then they've also found in their studies that it's those lines that were delivered along with a movement that get remembered the best. Those are the things that really stick in people's memories, actors and non-actors, that when people are moving in a way that corresponds in a meaningful way to what they're saying, they remember those words much better than if they were standing still or sitting still while they were speaking those lines. So there's something about tying words to actions in a meaningful way that really cements it in our memory.
The next thing you talk about is thinking in nature and natural spaces. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because I, you know, for myself, I know I've thought about my time in nature as a feeling, right? And not as helping my thinking. We did have Decker Keltner on the podcast, who you talk about his research in awe. And so tell us the different ways that we can be like more productive because we're thinking in nature, for example.
Well, I hate to put it that way, you know, because I do think being in nature is a good thing in itself. And you're right to notice that your mood is elevated in it when you're in nature. But there's a really interesting reason for that. There's probably several reasons for that. But one of them is that, you know, human beings evolved in the outdoors. You know, this life we live where we're almost always inside or in buildings or in cars is a very recent development in evolutionary timescales. And so the kind of information, the kind of stimuli that's available in outdoor settings, it's very easy for our brains to process. It's effortless for us to take in, you know, the sight of a tree or rolling waves or, you know, a sort of verdant scene is much easier for our brains to process than an urban scene with lots of, you know, sharp edges and fast moving objects. So it's very easy and effortless for us to process that information. And the brain, the things that it finds easy and effortless to process, it tends to attach a positive valence to. It tends to, it makes us feel good to be able to have our brains operating in that low key way instead of being so drained and drawn upon. And so that means that when you spend time in nature, you're effectively kind of refilling the tank of your attention. You know, we think so much about how we direct our attention and how we spend it or how it's being distracted, you know, but we don't really think about the supply side. Like where are those attentional resources being replenished and regenerated? And it turns out that spending time in nature is the fastest and easiest and most effective way to kind of restore our attentional capacities. So then we can go back to our offices and our desks and be productive.
And you talk in the book too about the, you know, when we're working on small screens, and I'm just looking around me, right? I've got my iPhone, I've got my iPad mini, I've got my computer, and then I've got my monitor. So increasingly larger screens, you know, a dance doing between these. And a few weeks ago, I met up with some college buddies in Denver, and we went hiking in the mountains, and it was like unbelievable. And the thing that struck me, and you talk about this in the book, is how small our thinking might be inside the iPhone, and the vastness of what I was thinking about and talking about for that weekend, because we were mostly outdoors and looking at this beautiful mountains and vistas. It's just the world seemed available, whereas often the world feels not.
Right. Yeah, I think you can think of it as like small screens breed small thoughts, you know? You know, people who study, scientists who study the effects of nature, will talk about the 3-day effect, meaning that, you know, we do get this boost in attention and focus when we go outside, even just for a 10-minute walk. But when people spend extended amounts of time in nature, and especially when they leave their devices behind, they get this really, this much bigger boost in creativity and ability to think in fresh and new ways. And some of that might be also what you talked about with Dr. Keltner about awe, that, you know, we're most likely to encounter a really awesome, majestic kind of overwhelming experience in nature. You're probably not going to have one when you're on your iPhone, right? No. And he and his co-authors talk about awe as a reset button for the human brain. Like it really kind of shakes up our settled and baked in mental schemas so that we really can open up our minds and think in new ways.
All right. So the just polar opposite of that, and we have talked a lot about this in the podcast, so I love that you go there, which is open offices. So working in built spaces and the scourge that is the open office. There's science behind this. Tell us why it's bad.
And maybe it won't come back, you know, after we've all been home and we're thinking about back into the office. Maybe this will finally kill off the open office once and for all. But the problem with the open office is that, you know, and to go back to evolution again, and what our brains evolved to do. They really evolved to be distracted, in the sense that any kind of novelty or movement or change in our surroundings could represent a threat or it could represent an opportunity. And either way, you wanted to be paying attention to that and aware of that. So we literally can't prevent ourselves from being, having our attention pulled to whatever's going on around us. And we're especially susceptible, human beings are especially susceptible to stimuli that are social, that have to do with other people. We can't help but process mentally the meaning of the words that we hear around us. So whether we want to be tuning in to our cubicle mates, you know, inane conversation or not, we process the semantic meaning of his words. And that uses up mental bandwidth that we want to be applying to our work. So my view is that if we want to do demanding, complex cognitive work, which a lot of our jobs call upon us to do, we need help. We need external help. We need walls, you know, to shield us from our own propensity for distraction. And that's exactly what the open office, you know, got rid of, with the idea that that would promote collaboration and serendipitous kind of collisions and conversations among people. But the problem is that, and interestingly, research finds that those kinds of spontaneous conversations actually decline when people move from private offices to an open office setting, because nobody wants to talk in, first of all, they don't have the privacy to have a discussion and not without, you know, hundreds of ears listening. And also when people retreat into themselves when they want to get work done. So they put up walls of a kind, you know, with their earbuds, or they shut other people out as a matter of survival. So actually conversation and sociability goes down among employees who are in an open office. So it actually kind of works against the very phenomenon that it was invented to promote.
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise for the few of us the handful of us who have come back to work at Second City are all the people who have offices. So when you go to the open office, there might be one or two people there, but that's uh-huh. never more than that.
Interesting, right?
Yeah,
right.
And so it's obvious in the Thinking with the Space of Ideas chapter. Yeah. I thought of when we're creating a Second City show, and the actors are writing the material, but the director is guiding it. And what the director does is has cards, different colored cards that represent whether they're scenes or what we call blackouts, which are short scenes, songs, improvisation, and then that goes on a wall and moves around. And it's I've seen, you know, certainly working with my friends at IDEO, you know, they're all about the post-its. They're just like, must spend a lot of money on post-its.
Post-its, right. I'm right behind them. Yeah, I'm a big post-it fan myself. But that they're really onto something in the sense that, you know, we really try to do too much in our heads. We have this idea that, like, if you're really smart, if you're really on top of things, you can get it all done up here, you know, but actually it's much more efficient and effective to offload the contents of your mind onto physical space in some way, whether that's post-it notes or like a big whiteboard or a multi-monitor display. You know, we were talking about, you and I were talking about the drawbacks of a small screen, when you can make screens into a kind of three-dimensional landscape that you're mm-hmm. actually in some way relating to with your body. All these embodied resources like spatial memory and proprioception come into play that don't just get wasted really when all the stuff goes on up here in your head.
I really was struck by what you called the cult of originality. And I get brought in a lot to talk about innovation and creativity and, mm-hmm. you know, cause we build new shows all the time and that's a thing. And so I'm very centered on that, but also I'm rooted in the past and the understanding. Mm-hmm. So when you get hired into the touring company at Second City, which is like the AAA, you know, farm system for the resident stages, mm-hmm. you are performing best of Second City shows all over the country. These are material written by Tina Fey or Stephen Colbert or Keegan-Michael Key. So it's the classics. Huh. And so what I thought about with this, I'm like, oh, that's like sort of this embodied learning of what it means to do successful sketch comedy. That then when you go on a stage, you're writing your own. But that's mm-hmm. a form of training in and of itself.
And that makes perfect sense, actually, because, you know, for centuries, education systems were based on this idea that the way you master a body of knowledge or a body of skills is that you emulate the people who've already gotten really good at it. And only then, once you've learned all that from the inside by imitation and emulation, then you can add your own twist, or then you can create your own masterpiece. But the way you learn is by copying, really. And there was not at one time there wasn't the shame or the stigma that there is attached to imitation now, you know. And I think that's part of the rise of this cult of originality that I write about in the book, that we have this idea that the only thing of value is something new, something original, something first time ever, you know, when really there's so much to be learned from the past masters. And I think probably a lot of comedians honed their craft by watching and rewatching, you know, Richard Pryor.
Hours, of course. Right. And listening is my wife's runs the first ever major in comedy writing and performance at Columbia College. She's a comedy professor. So she's literally like playing Newhart records and showing them, you know, Charlie Chaplin. And it's so good for their training in terms of understanding everything that came before them. And even like she has a thing where, when she's teaching vaudeville, where everyone has to do a different vaudeville act. So they get to learn what that was. And then, of course, that gives you the grounding on which to deviate. There's another interesting aspect of this when you talk about what in America's Cup, what some of the, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So this was research done by a couple of business school professors, actually, who looked at what happens in these failing races. And they found, this was very surprising to me, that often the boat that is in the lead will begin copying all the maneuvers of the boat behind them, which is, you know, it's kind of like, wait, you're in front. Like, aren't you kind of leading the way? But the point is, if you already have a lead and then you're just doing what the person behind you is doing, you're going to maintain that lead, right? And so the business school professors were applying this to the business world and saying, you know, it's not, we think of copying as something that the second place and the also rans, you know, do to emulate the person in front. But sometimes the person who's number one can benefit from looking at back at, you know, at the people behind them.
We were talking before we started taping about my interview with Paul Bloom. And one of the things he talks about in his book is fiction. And how we experience the world through these stories. And often there's almost always conflict in any good story. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't even have to have a happy ending. You know, it's like Rocky Lost. Mm-hmm. But we still get something out of that experience. Yeah. And you talk in the book, you say, quote, when we listen to a story, our brains experience the action as if it were happening to us.
Yes.
So talk to us a bit about that.
Yes. Yeah. There's a couple ways in which stories, which I'm sure you end up talking quite a lot about on this podcast, mm-hmm. stories are so fundamental to the human experience. Psychologists talk about them as being psychologically privileged in the sense that our brains are kind of, they evolved to understand material in the form of stories. And we tend to pay more attention to stories. We understand them better. We are more likely to remember the content when it's in a story, and we're more likely to act on what we hear when it's a story. And yet, when you think about how often the information we encounter is really in these kind of, in the form of these kind of dry instructions or manual formats, when really all of that information could be phrased as a story, you know, so often students or employees will be given information in this dry sort of format. And one point I make in the book is like, if we were to read a novel or sit down to watch a TV show, and there was no conflict and no tension and no kind of question of, well, what's going to happen next? You know, those things that make us keep watching or keep reading, we would turn off that TV show or we would put down that book pretty quickly. And yet we drain, you know, so much of what we encounter as students or as employees is completely drained of like any kind mm-hmm. of conflict or tension or question or suspense, you know? And so why not take advantage of this form that seems to be so integral to the way we understand information? Why not, you know, put everything into a story as much as possible, just because it's so congenial to the human brain?
So one of the things that a business line we have at Second City is called Real Biz Shorts. And what it is we create these short little funny vignettes to accompany ethics and compliance training. So it's like the most important training, right, that you have. And it's so boring. It's so dry.
And what breaks it up
is Second City coming along and doing like a really funny skit about doing it the wrong way.
That's brilliant. I mean, how much more will people remember that than like just another kind of dry as dust kind of recitation of rules?
Yeah, and it's Fortune 1000 companies that are buying it because they recognize how important. And the newest one that we're doing, we started filming yesterday. We're doing a sort of soup to nuts sexual harassment program. All based in sort of story. And it's so funny because a couple of the people who came in that we hired from the outside were like, this is like, I've had to take this training and it's terrible. This is fantastic that you're doing this. It's like a public service.
Yeah, really, really. Oh, gosh. Wow, that's playing on the edge there, though, right?
It is playing on the edge, but that's where we like to be. Okay, in a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before we do that, I want you to talk about socially distributed cognition. So this is in the section that talks about thinking with groups. And this is what we do. We work in groups. That's how we create. It's not always easy, but we talk about building ensembles. Mm-hmm. One of the lines that we say is that, you know, people often think of the adage, your group is only as good as its weakest member. And for us, it's like your group is only as good as its ability to compensate for its weakest member, because one of us is going to be the weakest member at a certain time.
Interesting. Yeah.
And that's a very pro-social way of having the group operate together. So talk to us about socially distributed cognition.
Yeah. So socially distributed cognition pushes back against the idea that thinking happens inside individual brains. You know, more and more our thinking has to happen in groups, because we need groups to solve the kinds of problems that we confront as a society and that we confront in our workplaces. So, you know, psychologists have this term. There's two terms they use to describe that feeling of a group of people kind of all being on the same page. They call it entitivity, like how much does a group of individuals feel like an entity, like a cohesive group. But my preferred term, which they also use, this is actually a scientific term, is groupiness, like how much of a sense of groupiness does this team have? And there are some kind of tried and true ways of hacking the natural human inclination to want to be a part of a group, you know, actually sort of engineering that and making that happen, making groupiness come together. And one way is, interestingly, synchronous movement. You know, this is why institutions of all kinds, like churches and militaries, have people do things in concert. They move as one body. And there's something about a group of people moving at the same time in the same way that kind of tricks our brain into thinking like, oh, maybe we're all kind of one, you know, maybe this is what happens at a rave, you know, where people are all dancing and they get this feeling. And there's probably some other reasons why they might experience that blurring of boundaries, but, you know, synchronous movement. So if you can get people even just walking together, because when people walk together, they tend to fall into a rhythm where they're actually kind of they're in a way mirroring each other's movements. But there are other things like having emotional experiences together, which I think I'm sure happens a lot in improvisational kind of situations where you laugh together, or you feel sad together, or you have an intense experience together. And that bonds people together so that they can think more effectively together. And then things like having rituals together, like partaking in rituals together, can really bring people together, including just a simple thing like sharing a meal. And one of my favorite like little tips from this book is that people tend to feel closer to each other and more on the same page when they eat family style, like out of the same shared dish. And going back to what we just said about having an intense experience together, if the food is really spicy, that actually like, you know, elevates our heart rate and gets our perspiration going and stuff. So spicy food served family style, I think, is the way to go for your next team meeting.
Excellent. We'll do it. All right. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, people get nowhere by saying no. They actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say yes and to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a story for us?
I do. So the book I wrote before The Extended Mind was called Origins, and it's about the science of prenatal influences, about how what a woman experiences when she's pregnant, how that affects her fetus and her eventual child. And when that book came out, I received an invitation to speak at Liberty University, which is
okay, I see where this is going.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been invited to speak at many universities, but never one like this that was, you know, a biblical kind of very religiously oriented organization. And I debated it. And then I thought, you know what, I'll go, I'll do it, I'll see what it's like. And I won't lie, there were lots of things about it that were really odd. Like in my hotel room that they'd arranged for me when I arrived in Lynchburg, I think it's in Lynchburg, Virginia. Yeah. My sort of welcoming gift was a very fancy box, and I opened it, and inside were a whole bunch of M&Ms that were printed with my initials. To this day, I can't explain why, but that was just the gift that I had. I had a whole bunch of AMP printed M&Ms, you know. So, and so I went the next day to give my talk at Liberty University. I will never speak. I feel confident saying this. I will never speak to a larger audience, because they have this sort of required convocation like several times a week, I think, and all the students are required to be there. So I was speaking to 12,000 people. And and the week before, Ted Cruz, this was a number of years ago, Ted Cruz had been the speaker announcing his run for president. So there I was. And actually, before I came on, there was a warm-up. The warm-up was a Christian rock band. So I'm definitely standing backstage thinking, what have I gotten myself into? What kind of reception am I going to get here? And here I am, a science writer, talking about pregnancy. And you know, there's all kinds of issues that I know are swirling in the minds of the people who I'm going to be speaking to. But I just thought, you know what, just go out there, do your thing. You're a science writer, present what you know from the research. And I did that. And the students were very polite and very receptive. And then I did a book signing afterwards. And a student came up to me and said, she thanked me really in a really heartfelt way. And she said, you know, we don't really have scientists come here to talk to us, or we don't have people come here to talk to us about science. You know what, Kelly, let me just say the whole thing again. So after I gave the talk, we did a book signing, and a student came up to me and she said in a really heartfelt way, you know, we don't really have people come here to talk to us about science. And I found your talk really interesting, and I really appreciate that you came. And so I was so grateful and to yeah. her for telling me that, and so glad that I had come to this place that didn't feel necessarily like a comfortable place for me to be. But in the end, I felt like I'd done the right thing by going there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially living in the world we live in now, right? Where no one wants to speak across difference, and we block, and we, you know, and everyone does it, and everyone points the finger at the other way. And it's like, I find in my experience with, when I sit with most people, there's stuff that they can contribute and that they can take from me. And it's just, it's, you know, this is going to be a battle, and it's just one that we gotta do. The book is called The Extended Mind, The Power of Thinking Outside the Brain. Annie Murphy-Paul, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you, Kelly. This has been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by The Second City, Second City Works, and WGN Radio. It's also produced by Elif Garris, with help by Mike Farinacchio and Colleen Fahey. The music that you hear that intros and outros the program is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you want to get more information on The Second City, you can reach us at www.secondcityworks.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
Screaming atop of their lungs. survive.